Welcome back to the deep dive. I want to start today by putting a specific image in your head. I want you to picture a mountaineer. Let's call him the Racer. He has spent his entire adult life climbing. He's got the pickaxe, the crampons, the oxygen tank. He is covered in sweat, his adrenaline is pumping, and he has spent 30, maybe 40 years focused on exactly one thing: getting to the summit.
It's the classic hero's journey, the struggle, the ascent, the conquering of the peak.
Right. But here is the scene I want to paint for you today. The Racer finally gets there. He reaches the summit. The view is incredible. The air is clear. He has won the game. But instead of enjoying the view, he starts looking around for rocks to move. He starts trying to rearrange the snow. He's still swinging that pickaxe, hacking away at the ground, even though there is no more mountain to climb.
That is a terrifying image. It's Sisyphus, but Sisyphus who doesn't know he's finished the task.
Exactly. And that is what we are talking about today. Usually on this show, we are down at base camp. We're talking about how to pack the bag, what stocks to buy, what trends to watch, how to beat the market. But today we are helicoptering to the top. We are diving deep into the work of author Jocelyn Dubé.
A truly fascinating thinker who sits right at the intersection of, well, finance and philosophy.
Specifically, we are tackling the fourth and final installment of his Wealth Architecture series from his book, The Infinite Investor. The piece is titled The Way to the Mountain Guide. And look, I'll be honest with you. When I first saw that title, I thought, okay, great. Another retirement planning guide, save 4%, buy bonds, see you later.
And you were wrong.
I was dead wrong. This isn't a how-to on withdrawal rates or tax strategies. This is a philosophical investigation into an existential crisis. It asks the question that almost nobody in the financial industry wants to ask. What happens when you actually win the game?
It represents a shift in the entire paradigm. Jocelyn Dubé is arguing that this skills required to get rich, the skills of the downhill racer, are actually destructive once you are rich. The very things that got you up the mountain will throw you off the cliff if you don't stop doing them.
That's the hook right there. The skills that got you here will destroy you if you keep using them.
Exactly. And Dubé frames this as the necessary transition from the downhill racer, the accumulator, the hustler, to the mountain guide. And you know, making that shift is much, much harder than just changing your asset allocation. It requires rewriting your entire identity.
So let's get into the architecture of this shift. But before we get to the solution, we have to understand the problem. In the previous deep dives on Jocelyn Dubé's work, we talked about a concept he calls the attention cost. Refresh our memory on that because it feels like the foundation for everything we're discussing today.
Right. So the attention cost was a concept regarding position sizing. Dubé argued that if you have a stock position that is tiny, say 0.2% of your portfolio, it is mathematically irrational to spend any time researching it.
Because even if it goes to the moon, it doesn't change your life.
Correct. Do the math. If you have a $100,000 portfolio and you have $200 in a speculative stock and that stock goes up 100%, you $200.
Which is nice, but it's a dinner out. It's not retirement.
Exactly. But if you spent 10 hours researching that stock, reading the balance sheet, listening to earnings calls, you effectively worked for $20 an hour. For a high-performing investor, that is a terrible return on attention. You are misallocating your mental bandwidth.
Okay, so that makes sense for a single stock. But here is where Dubé makes this massive fractal leap in this final chapter. He argues that this same math applies to the entire portfolio relative to the investor's life.
This is the concept he calls when the portfolio becomes the position. And this is the hardest pill for wealthy people to swallow.
Walk me through that, because to me, the portfolio is the main event. It's the nest egg. It's the result of decades of work. How can the whole portfolio be a small position?
It becomes small relative to the remaining time you have to enjoy it.
Okay, I need you to unpack that. That sounds profound, but I need to get my head around it.
Well, think about the scaling law here. When you are 25 years old, you are the racer. Your financial capital is low. You might have $10,000 to your name, maybe some student debt.
Mm-hmm.
But your human capital, your energy, your future earnings, your time horizon is massive. You are time rich, cash poor.
Right. So every dollar I save has decades to grow. The power of compounding is on my side.
Exactly. Every hour you spend optimizing your money has a massive multiplier effect. If you learn to invest well at 25, that knowledge compounds for 50 years. The marginal utility of spending a Saturday analyzing stocks is incredibly high. You are building the engine that will power your life.
Okay. So the hustle makes sense. The obsession makes sense. It's actually the rational thing to do.
It is. Now, fast forward. You are 55 or 60. You've won. You are the mountain god.
Yeah.
You have $5 million or $10 million in the bank. Your financial capital is huge. But human capital, your time, that is now the scarce resource.
The sand is running out of the hourglass.
And that's where the math flips. Dubé's argument is that at this stage, the portfolio itself is just a utility. It's a battery. It's a tool. If you are still spending your scarce Saturdays obsessing over the screens, trying to squeeze out an extra 0.5% return, you are misallocating your attention to a position that no longer requires it.
You're treating the portfolio as the protagonist of the movie when it was supposed to be the supporting actor that paid for the production of the movie.
Beautifully put. You have confused the car with the road trip.
Yeah.
And the tragedy, as Dubé points out, is that the math supports this view, but our psychology fights it tooth and nail.
Let's look at that math, because he doesn't just say money buys less happiness. He brings in the receipts. He cites Daniel Bernoulli.
Yes, the Swiss mathematician. This takes us back to 1738.
1738, wow. We are talking about pre-industrial revolution thinking here.
But the logic is timeless. Bernoulli formalized the utility function of wealth. And the formula is simple. U of W equals the natural log of W.
Okay, for the listener who hasn't touched a graphing calculator since high school calculus, and I include myself in that group, what is the natural log of wealth? What does that shape actually look like?
Imagine a curve that starts by shooting straight up. It's almost vertical. That's when you're going from zero to your first $10,000. Every dollar is life-changing. It's food, it's rent, it's safety. But then, very quickly, the curve starts to flatten out. It keeps going up, but it gets flatter and flatter and flatter.
So the relationship between money and happiness, or utility, as the economists call it, isn't a straight line.
It is strictly logarithmic. A dollar is a dollar in the market. The bank counts every dollar the same. But a dollar is not a dollar in your nervous system. Your brain does not experience it linearly.
Dubé breaks down the data on this, and the numbers are startling.
They are. He uses a relative impact model to show this decay. He says, look at a portfolio of $100,000. At that level, a single dollar of gain implies a certain amount of life improvement. Buying better food, fixing the car, ensuring safety. Let's call that a baseline impact.
Okay, so that dollar matters. It has real, tangible value in your life.
Now, fast forward. You have $5 million, that same dollar of gain. It has 1/50th of the impact on your well-being.
1/50th. That is a massive drop-off. It's almost a rounding error in terms of your actual happiness.
And at $10 million, it drops to half of that again. So to get the same emotional hit, the same dopamine rush, or the same actual lifestyle improvement that you got from a $1,000 gain when you were starting out, you would need a $50,000 or $100,000 gain now.
That makes intuitive sense. I remember when I was a student, finding a $20 bill on the sidewalk was the highlight of my month. It meant pizza and beer for the weekend. Now, I mean, I'd pick it up, but I wouldn't call my mom about it.
Precisely. The utility has collapsed. But here is the logarithmic trap that Jocelyn Dubé identifies. The rewards, the utility, the happiness collapse logarithmically. But the effort required to manage the money, that remains linear.
Oh, that's the kicker. That is the trap.
It takes just as much work to read a 10K report, whether you own $10,000 of the stock or $10 million. It takes just as much intellectual labor to understand a macro trend. It takes just as much emotional energy to weather a 20% drawdown. The market doesn't care how rich you are. The work is the work.
So you end up, as Dubé puts it, running the same process for a fraction of the payoff.
You are running a marathon for a T-shirt when you used to run it for a gold medal, and your legs are getting tired.
Why do we do it? If the math is so clear that the effort isn't worth the reward anymore, why are there so many wealthy people who are still glued to CNBC every morning? Why are they still refreshing their brokerage apps 5 times a day?
Identity. Dubé calls this the racer's identity. You have to remember, if you've accumulated significant wealth, you didn't do it by accident. You did it because you were good at the game. You were disciplined. You were a researcher. You were an optimizer. You were the person who said no to spending so you could say yes to investing.
It's who you are. It's ingrained in your neural pathways. It's your self-concept.
Exactly. You're the guy who finds the undervalued companies.
Yeah.
You're the woman who understands the bond yield curve. To stop doing that, to stop optimizing, it feels like a death.
It feels like you're losing your edge, like you're getting lazy.
It feels like laziness. It feels like giving up. But Dubé argues that this laziness is actually a higher form of evolution. It's a necessary next step. And that's where this next idea comes in, which I think is just a brilliant piece of framing.
This leads us to a really powerful visualization in the text, the crossing point. I want everyone listening to close their eyes for a second. Unless you're driving, please keep them open and visualize a graph. You've got two curves crossing in an X shape.
Yes. Curve number one is that logarithmic curve we just talked about. The declining marginal utility of money. It starts high and crashes down as you get richer.
And curve number two.
That is the rising marginal value of time. And it's rising really steeply.
Now explain that. Why does the value of time skyrocket? Obviously, we're all dying, so there's scarcity.
Scarcity is the first factor, and it's the most obvious one. If you are 60, you simply have fewer Saturdays left than when you were 30. Basic economics. When supply goes down, value goes up. But Dubé points out a second, more subtle reason, opportunity.
How so?
Wealth allows you to do more with your time. When you're broke, your time is often restricted. You have to work two jobs. You can't travel. You can't fund a passion project. Your free time is often just recovery time.
Right. You're just trying to get enough energy to go back to work. There's no real freedom in it.
Exactly. But when you're wealthy, every hour has infinite potential. You could be walking in Paris. You could be learning to fly a plane. You could be starting a charitable foundation. You could be spending high-quality, stress-free time with your grandkids.
So the opportunity cost of wasting an hour explodes upwards.
Yes. If you spend an hour staring at a Bloomberg terminal when you could be walking on a beach you own, that is a very, very expensive hour. You are burning diamonds to buy coal.
Burning diamonds to buy coal? That is a brutal image.
That's the trade. You are trading your most valuable asset, time, to acquire more of the asset you already have in abundance, which is money. It is a mathematically losing trade.
And the crossing point is the exact moment where those lines intersect, where time becomes strictly more valuable than money.
And Dubé says something pretty haunting here. He says that for many successful investors, the crossing happened years ago. They just never noticed.
They missed the shift.
They missed the bell. They are still acting like racers because nobody told them they are now guides. They're still accumulating, still optimizing, still stressing, unaware that the game has changed fundamentally.
Okay, so let's say we accept this. We realize, oh no, I'm past the crossing point. How do we change? How do we stop being the racer? Because just relax is terrible advice for a type A personality. You can't just tell a shark to stop swimming.
You can't tell a type of person to just chill. You have to give them a new framework, a new mission, a new definition of what winning looks like. And Dubé pivots here to something totally unexpected. He brings in Miyamoto Musashi,
the legendary Japanese swordsman,
the greatest duelist in Japanese history. He wrote the Book of Five Rings in 1645, just weeks before his death.
I love that Dubé does this. We go from Bernoulli's calculus to samurai sword fighting. Walk us through the rings and how they apply to my portfolio.
Musashi divides strategy into five elements: earth, water, fire, wind, and void. Dubé maps these to the investor's journey.
Earth and water are the basics.
Earth is the fundamentals. Grounding, accounting, understanding value. It's your foundation. Water is adaptation learning to flow with the market. Managing your emotions so you don't panic. You know, not fighting the current.
And then there's fire.
Fire is the racer. Fire is combat. It's high energy, constant decision-making, aggression. I'm going to beat the market. I'm going to find the alpha. I'm going to crush the competition. And Dubé says this is appropriate.
Right. He's not saying fire is bad. It's a necessary phase.
No. If you are building wealth, you need to be in the ring of fire. You need that heat to forge the steel. You need to be aggressive to accumulate the capital in the first place.
But you can't stay in the fire forever.
If you stay in the fire, you eventually burn out or you get burned. The strategy that got you to the summit is not the strategy for living on the summit.
So the mountain guide, the preservation phase, corresponds to the final ring. The void.
The void. Now, we need to clear up a translation issue here. In the West, void sounds nihilistic. It sounds like emptiness or nothing matters.
Yeah, it sounds like giving up, like staring into the abyss and the abyss stares back.
But in the Buddhist and martial arts tradition, the void is not emptiness. It is potential. It represents mastery so complete that it looks like inaction.
The discipline that no longer looks like discipline.
Think about a master swordsman versus a novice. The novice is jumping around, swinging wildly, expending huge amounts of energy. He is grunting. He is sweating. He is working hard.
And the master?
The master stands perfectly still. He barely breathes. The opponent strikes. The master moves 1 inch to the left, and the opponent collapses. That is the void. Maximum effect, minimum effort. No wasted motion.
So translate that to my brokerage account. What does the void look like for an investor?
It means the portfolio compounds without conscious direction. The discipline is internalized into the system. You are checking the price every day because you built an architecture that doesn't require you to check the price every day.
It's automated mastery. The work was done up front in the design.
It is knowing that your architecture is sound, so you don't need to tinker. And this brings us to the most critical technical section of the deep dive. We need to talk about the vase principle and ergodicity.
Oh, yes. This is the heavy lifting. And I want to be really careful here because there is a very high risk of confusion. Listeners might be familiar with Nassim Taleb's concept of the porcelain cup from his book, Antifragile.
Yes, and we need to make a sharp distinction here. Dubay is using a similar image, a fragile object, but he is flipping the meaning entirely. If you confuse Taleb's cup with Dubay's vase, you miss the whole point.
Okay, let's break it down. Taleb's porcelain cup.
Taleb uses the cup to represent fragility. If you drop a porcelain cup, meaning if the market crashes or there's a random shock or a black swan event, it breaks, it shatters, it is fragile to the outside world.
Okay, so external shocks destroy it. Simple enough. Now, contrast that with Dubay's vase, because he calls the guide's portfolio a vase.
But here's the twist. Dubay's vase, the guide's portfolio, is not fragile to the market.
Why not? How can a portfolio not be fragile to a crash? I mean, that's the definition of a portfolio, isn't it? It goes up and down with the market.
Because of the architecture. A true guide's portfolio holds cash, what Dubay calls the infinite option, to absorb the avalanche. It holds the index, which Dubay calls a self-cleansing Darwinian machine. The index naturally sheds losers and adds winners over time. It uses harvesting rules to turn volatility into fuel.
So the system itself is robust. It can take the earthquake. In fact, it might even benefit from the earthquake because you can buy cheap assets with your cash buffer.
Exactly. It is anti-fragile to the market. It feeds on the chaos. So unlike Taleb's cup, you can drop the vase into a bear market and it won't break.
Mm-hmm.
The system is designed for that specific eventuality.
So if the vase isn't fragile to the market, what is it fragile to? What's the real threat?
It is fragile to the owner.
The hand.
The hand. The vase is fragile to you. Jocelyn Dubay writes, the guide's deepest discipline is the discipline of the hand that does not reach.
That is such a powerful image. The idea that the market can't break your portfolio, only you can break it by trying to fix it.
This ties into the concept of ergodicity.
We love this word on the show, but let's define it for the new listeners. It sounds like something from a physics lecture.
It is from physics, but it applies to money perfectly. The simplest way to explain ergodicity is the Russian roulette example.
A cheery example.
Bear with me. If 6 people play Russian roulette once, 5 survive and 1 doesn't, the group average survival rate is 83%. If you look at the group, it looks like an 83% chance of winning. That's the ensemble average.
But if one person plays Russian roulette 6 times in a row,
the survival rate is 0. You will eventually hit the bullet. There is no long-term average to be had for you.
Because once you die, you can't play again. The chain of events is broken.
Exactly. That is a non-ergodic system. You get taken out of the game. In investing, ruin is the bullet. If you blow up your account, if you go to 0, you can't recover. You can't capture the long-term average return of the market if you aren't in the market anymore.
So the guide's portfolio is designed to be an ergodic system, a survival machine.
Correct. It is designed to stay in the game forever, to survive the crash, the recession, the war, the inflation. But here is the hard rule. Human intervention usually turns ergodic systems into non-ergodic ones.
We introduced the risk of ruin where there wasn't any before.
By leveraging up, by concentrating into sure things, by panic selling at the bottom because we're scared, by getting greedy at the top. We take a safe system and we make it dangerous by trying to be clever, by trying to be a racer.
Dubay has a great line about this. You cannot make an intact vase more intact.
It's so true. Think about it. It's either broken or it's not. There's no in between. If your portfolio is solvent, diversified, and meeting your needs, it is intact.
Mm.
Any intervention, any attempt to trade around it, to tinker, is essentially taking the vase off the shelf and juggling it.
You're trying to polish it, but you're risking dropping it.
Yeah.
And for what? a tiny bit more shine that you won't even notice?
Exactly. You cannot make it more intact. You can only risk breaking it. So the optimal strategy for the vase collector is to stop collecting behaviors and simply possess the vase.
That is so hard to do, though. We are wired to do something. When we see a problem or even just a calm market, we want to optimize. We want to be helpful. We want to earn our keep.
Which brings us to the specific assets that allow you to keep your hands in your pockets. The architecture that allows the guide to step back into the void. Dubé talks about the bucket system. Bucket 1 is cash, bucket 2 is the index. But he focuses deeply on bucket 3, the specific type of company he calls the free surfer.
The free surfer. It sounds like a California surf brand, but the math behind it is brilliant. He uses a formula. Revenue equals A times B.
Revenue equals A times B. Simple formula, profound implication.
Break down the variables for us. What's A and what's B?
A is the company's network or infrastructure. It's what they control, their platform, their product, their intellectual property.
Mm.
B is the world structural shift. It's what the world provides for free. It's a powerful, unstoppable tailwind.
The example he uses is Visa and digitalization, right?
It's the perfect case study. Think about Visa. What is A? It's their payment network, the rails that move the money. They built it, they maintain it, they control it. That is their surfboard.
And B?
B is the global shift from cash to digital payments. It's a tidal wave. It's happening everywhere, from New York to Nairobi. It's not driven by Visa. It's driven by technology, by governments, by consumer preference.
And the crucial point is that Visa doesn't have to pay for B.
Exactly. That's the magic. Visa doesn't have to convince a bodega in Brazil to switch to cards. The Brazilian government does that. Customers do that. Amazon forces you to use a card. Uber forces you to use a card. The world is providing the energy.
So the company rides the wave using its board. It just has to stay balanced.
And crucially, this growth doesn't require the company to fight for it. It doesn't require aggressive marketing wars or cutting prices. It's a structural tailwind. It just happens to them.
Why is this the perfect asset for the mountain guide?
Because it fits the philosophy of the void. It requires zero stress or pushing from the investor. It grows via the world's energy, not the investor's anxiety. You don't need to worry if the CEO had a good quarter. You just need to know if the ocean still has waves.
It is an asset that embodies Wu Wei action through non-action.
Precisely. If you own a free surfer, you don't need to check the quarterly earnings to see if the CEO is a genius. You just need to ask one question. Is the wave still moving? Is the world still going digital? If yes, you do nothing. You let it ride.
It sounds so peaceful, just checking the wave conditions. But
yeah.
Let's be real. Even with a portfolio like that, the itch to optimize is real. Dubé calls this the optimization illusion.
He does. And he gets a bit aggressive here. He attacks the industry because the entire financial industry is built on selling you optimization.
We can save you 2 basis points. We can get you tax loss harvesting. We can find you the next NVIDIA. We can beat the benchmark.
Right. It's all noise. And Dubé asks, why is trying to get better returns actually destructive at this stage? It's not just useless, it's actively harmful.
He calls it the math of irrelevance.
Let's look at the 100-bagger myth. Everyone wants to find the next Amazon, right? It's the holy grail of investing. But do the math. Suppose you have a $10 million portfolio. You are a mountain guide. You put $10,000 into a speculative startup stock.
Okay, small bet. 0.1% of the portfolio, just for fun.
Let's say you are a genius and it goes up 100 times. That $10,000 becomes $1 million.
That's a huge win. I made $1 million. I'm a hero.
Did you? Your portfolio went from $10 million to $11 million. Your life hasn't changed at all.
When you put it that way, it does take the shine off a bit.
You still live in the same house. You eat the same food. You fly the same class. You worry about the same things. The utility of that extra million is almost zero. But to find that 100-bagger, how much time did you spend?
Probably hundreds of hours. Researching, stressing.
How much stress? How many losers did you pick before you found that one winner? How many nights did you stay up worrying about the position size? You traded hundreds of hours of your most precious resource time for a financial gain that had no material impact on your life.
So even the home run doesn't actually move the needle on your lived experience.
Exactly. And the small stuff is even worse. Saving 0.02% in fees. Or tax loss harvesting to save $400.
It's negligible. It's a rounding error on a portfolio of that size.
But the cost is not negligible because the cost is time. And remember the crossing point. Time is now the resource that is more valuable than money.
So when you spend a beautiful Saturday morning indoors stressing over spreadsheets to save $400 in taxes on a $10 million portfolio.
You are literally burning gold to save pennies.
That is a brutal image. Burning gold to save pennies.
Dubé diagnoses this as a failure of proportion. The investor fails to see that the game has changed. They are playing the old game of accumulation with the tools of the new reality. They're using a microscope when they should be looking at the horizon.
And it comes back to identity, doesn't it? If I stop optimizing, if I stop hunting for the 100-bagger, am I still an investor? Who am I?
That's the crisis. Stopping optimization feels like stepping away from the self for a career investor. It feels like abandoning your post. But Dubé argues it is actually the highest form of discipline.
The discipline of refusal. The discipline of knowing when to stop.
Yes. The discipline to say, I have enough. The system works. My job is to protect the vase, not to paint it. My job is to live the life that the money was meant to support.
This leads us to the conclusion where Dubé brings it all together. He calls it the convergence. And honestly, seeing these three names together on a page was kind of a shock.
It's the ultimate unlikely dinner party. You'd love to be a fly on that wall.
Yeah. He brings together Miyamoto Musashi, the samurai, Lao Tzu, the Taoist sage, and Marcus Aurelius, the Stoic emperor.
And he shows that despite living in different eras and cultures, they are all climbing the same mountain. They're all pointing to the same summit from different sides.
Walk us through the synthesis. How do these three fit together in his framework?
Musashi represents the void. Mastery leads to effortless action. You train so hard that you don't need to think. You don't try to strike. The strike just happens.
Right.
The vase stays on the shelves not because you are lazy, but because you are disciplined enough not to touch it.
And Lao Tzu, the Taoist angle.
Lao Tzu represents Wu Wei. The Tao does nothing, and yet nothing is left undone. This is the idea that the best way to govern or to invest is often to interfere as little as possible. Let the compounding happen. Don't pull up the flowers to see if the roots are growing.
That is the hardest thing for an investor to do, to trust the roots, to not constantly check on them.
And Marcus Aurelius, stoicism, the discipline of the controllable, you build the architecture, that's in your control, you accept the market, that's out of your control, you don't rage against the storm, you just make sure your shelter is built, you don't check the weather app every 5 minutes, you just build a strong roof and trust it.
And then, just when you think we're getting too esoteric, Dubé throws in a fourth name, a modern billionaire.
Charlie Munger.
The late, great Charlie Munger. What's the quote he uses?
Sit on your ass investing.
It's so perfect. It's so blunt.
It is. Munger said, you're paying less to brokers, you're listening to less nonsense, and if it works, the tax system gives you an extra 1, 2, or 3 percentage points per annum. It's pure pragmatic wisdom.
It's amazing because Munger is basically Lao Tzu in a Berkshire Hathaway suit.
He is. The ancient sage and the modern billionaire are giving the exact same advice. The highest form of action is often inaction. But, and this is critical, it is informed inaction. It's not laziness. It's not, I don't know what to do, so I'll do nothing. It is, I know exactly what to do, and the answer is nothing.
That's a huge distinction. That's the whole ballgame right there.
It's the difference between a sleeping guard and a guard who is watching so carefully he doesn't need to move.
So, if we zoom out to the big picture of this entire series, from the attention cost to the sizing to this final piece, what is the ultimate message?
The message is that the transition from racer to guide isn't about retiring. It's not about checking out or dying. It's about freedom.
Freedom from the machine you built.
Exactly. The portfolio is a vehicle, not a destination. If you build a Ferrari, the point is to drive it to the beach, not to spend the rest of your life in the garage polishing the engine with a toothbrush.
A vehicle that requires constant repair is a prison.
That's the line. If your portfolio needs you to check it every day, you haven't built wealth. You've built a job, and a stressful one at that. You've just become a highly paid but still chained portfolio manager for yourself.
This has been heavy in a good way. It really forces you to look at why we do this, why we invest in the first place.
It does. It asks, what is the point of winning if you don't know how to claim the prize? The prize isn't the number on the screen. The prize is the time the number buys you.
I think we should end with Jocelyn Dubé's final words from the post. They carry so much weight.
I agree. It's a mantra for the mountain guide. He writes, capital compounds in the portfolio. Attention compounds in the investor. Time compounds in no one. Protect it above all else.
Time compounds in no one. That is going to stick with me for a long time.
It should. It's the only resource that is strictly finite. You can always make more money. You can never make more time.
Well, on that note, we are going to wrap up this deep dive into Jocelyn Dubé's The Infinite Investor. It's a lot to process.
It is. This is one you have to sit with.
So maybe take a walk, go outside, don't check the markets for an hour, practice the void.
Sounds like a plan.
Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll see you on the next deep dive.
Goodbye.